I almost didn't make it tonight. Not because of the very excellent meal that my host gave me, but this afternoon I was brought to the sorority, the Kappa Kappa Gamma, and I almost decided to stop there. But I hear this is also a girl's dormitory, so... The first poem I'm going to read is The Swimmer. The swimmer is the poet. He lives in two worlds, two realms. And that, of course, is the difficulty as well as the glory that confronts him. The Swimmer. The afternoon for closing, see the swimmer plunges from his raft, opening the spray corallas by his act of war. The snakeheads strike quickly and are silent. Emerging, see how for a moment a brown weed with marvelous bulbs. He lies imminent upon the water, while light and sound come with a sharp passion from the gonad sea around the poles and break in bright cockle shells about his ears. He dives, floats, goes under like a thief, where his blood sings to the tiger shadows and the scentless greenery that leads him home. A male salmon down fretted stairways through underwater slums. Stunned by the memory of lost gills, he frames gestures of self-absorption upon the skull-like beach, observes with instigated eyes the sun that empties itself upon the water and the last wave romping in to throw its boyhood on the marble sand. Haruspex, a poem about the Cold War. I'm out with my daughter, who was in her crib. She was very small then, and the clouds of war seemed much darker than they seem today, and they're fairly dark at the moment, I understand. And you look at your daughter and you wonder what it's all about. You look up at the sky and you're looking for symbols, for hope, for prophetic signs. Haruspex. As the afternoon wore on, the wind rose like an American tariff. I, more credulous than my parents, sat on my garden stool, hoping for signs. Something perhaps to fall out of the sky. An eagle like a piece of gunmetal cracking the wall of air, flashing the forbidden message from broken wings. Perhaps a never-before-seen snake, or at the least a typewriter in the tall grass. Its keys plucked by a legion of dry crickets. But all I saw were great swathes of shadow moving across the fields like escaped jailbirds. All afternoon I watched the Mediterranean sky dotted with soft silver-ringed clouds like Greek city-states, like white garlands for an Athenian holiday. But look, in the north the Macedonian king has fastened his gray tunic and moves slowly, slowly down the Thracian plains. An armorer gathers the crimson dagger blades. The heavens darken, and all about me the rabble grass, abject, whitens under the cruel sky wind. Oh, helmeted goddess, my little one, head nesting on arm, I am afraid. On my way to school, this used to comfort me when I was a small boy and would go to school. There was a sign on a church, Jesus Saves. And for a fellow who was late, this was a very comforting thing to see. I went back several years later, and there had been some changes, and this is what I record. On my way to school. On my way to school, I used to pass a Baptist church and fields of grass. Jesus Saves, above the gate, would comfort me if I were late. The church is gone, the street is paved, the home bank thrives where Jesus saved. And what do you think of when you see a newsboy? He's got the whole world on his back. He touches the world at a million points, all sensitive. newsboy. Neither tribal nor trivial, he shouts from the city center where tram cars move like stained bacilli across the eyeballs, where people spore in composite buildings from their protective gelatin of doubts, old ills, and incapacity to love. While he, a Joshua before their walls, sells newspapers to the gods and geldings. Intrusive as a collision, he is the zeitgeist to public interpreter, a voice multiplex and democratic, the people's voice or the monopolist's, who with last edition of Nicians plays Clotho to each gaping customer with halcyon colt, sex crime in an attic, the story of a twice-jailed bigamist. For him, the mitered cardinals sweat in conclaves domed. The spy is shot. Empiric and obstreperous confidant of kings, rude despiser of the anonymous, Danubes of blood wash up his bulletins while he domesticates disaster like a wheat in pampas of prescriptive things with cries animal and ambiguous. His dialectics will assault the brain, contrive men to voyages or murder, dip the periscope of their public lives to the green levels of acidic caves, fever their health or heal them with ruin or with lies dangerous as a letter, finally unfold the season's clothes, cover a somnolent face on Sundays. A very old woman. Old woman, your face is a halo of praise that excludes nothing, not even death. I have looked upon your waxy and virginal torso, and I see you now as a frail candle whose flame, the initial sputter of ignition over, burns gently and with composure. So the first taste of death was bitter. Now you burn with a composed glow, listening, half amused like a superior person to your bridegroom, which is the darkness, while each hour of your lovely embrace descends in ecstatic beads of silence. Old woman, what does he say, your bridegroom? That his child death grows in my womb. What else, old woman? That only my white and virginal skin seals off the darkness from the death within. Old woman with face ageless like snow, what will you do now? Flame serenely, till like a warm candle I curve over the arm of my hurrying bridegroom and lover. Is that all, old woman? Yes. No. When death and darkness embrace over me, I shall have no face. I shall be utterly gone. Use the blackened wick for a headstone.
May I interrupt? Anytime you want to ask questions of Mr. Layton on any poem that he's reading, am I right? It's all right?
Or would you rather? No, I'd rather read right through and then right. If there are any
Sorry.
Questions.
Pardon me.
It's all right. Here's a poem about the poet's love of the earth, of the world he lives on, and his dislike of it. I always figure the poet as one who blesses and curses. And this is one of those poems that blesses and curses. It's called Tareen. The sun's a red-faced major that has no use for a prefatory memoir. And this life a bourgeois who calls from his toilet seat, Maria, I love you. Do you love me too, sweet? And power everything. I am exhausted like a poem or a landscape over which too many people have exclaimed. Still, You flower in my mind like a shop girl wooed by many dark maharajas. I shall knock out of your hand all your lottery tickets. You will be left with nothing but my love. Some years ago, when I was teaching high school, this was grade 11, the last grade in high school, there were six girls in my class who were exceptionally pretty and exceptionally provocative and knew it. And while I would be giving a serious lecture in history or literature, one or two of them would provocatively, you know, sort of press against the breast, and then it would be very difficult for me to carry on. So I've immortalized them in this poem, which gives you my predicament. To the girls of my graduating class, wanting for their young limbs praise, their thighs, hips, and saintly breasts, they grow from awkwardness to delight, their mouths made perfect with the air about them and the sweet rage in the blood, the delicate trouble in their veins. Intolerant as happiness, suddenly they'll dart like bewildered birds, for there's no mercy in that bugler time that excites against their virginity the massed infantry of days, nor in the tendrils greening on their enchanted battlements. Golda, Fruma, Dini, Eleanor, my saintly wantons, passionate nuns, oh, light-footed daughters, your unopened, brittle beauty troubles an aging man who hobbles after you a little way, fierce and ridiculous. And I don't know whether you've had this experience at this school, but at McGill, where I was taught philosophy, it sometimes seemed to me that the teacher was doing his utmost to brown the students off philosophy so that they would hate the subject forever. It was so dead. I'm sure this doesn't happen here, but it has happened in Canada. So here's an ironic poem called Philosophy 34. When I was at McGill, O world, O time, I ran upstairs, two stairs at, I was in such a bang into my seat I slid, and there were a lot of defunct birds lying about. A blue discoloration on their stripped bodies, as well as a professor luculently explaining how admirable their wings were for mounting when alive. In the Ambrosian air, we formed a half circle on fire to probe the darkening alar flesh when an Apollonian roared from the backside of the room, "What shameful rites are these? What desecration?" In the perturbation, the professor was ditched by mistake, but I, of course, stayed on. I saw a bronze goddess whose profile enchanted me all the way down. The Madonna of the Magnificat. It's a street scene. Some Italians, an Italian woman on a porch, a child at her breast, and her other daughters around her. The Madonna of the Magnificat. I shall wander all night and not see as much happiness as this infant gives to his plain sisters who are adoring him and his mother cradling and covering him with her love. She has borrowed the white moon from the sky to pillow his golden curls, and at her magical cry, the dark roofs the length of the street lie down like quiet animals. The night will wear out and disappear like soiled water through the city's drains, but now it is full of noise and blessed neighbors, and all the tenement windows fly open like birds. Seven o'clock lecture. The complaint of the teacher of English literature. He gets terribly excited about something. He's talking about Hamlet or King Lear. He's getting terribly excited, and he's really going wild. And then some student from the back puts up his hand and says, "Sir, sir, will this be on the examination?" Life has a discouraging moment.
On your right. Give Mrs. Layton a turn to say hi, folks.
Oh, yes. 7 o'clock lecture. This is an evening where I teach. Filling their ears with the immortal claptrap of poetry, these singular lies with a power to get themselves believed, the permanent bloom on all time infecteth things, indicating the will to falsehood in the hearts of men, the music in a pismire's walk, the necessary glory of dung, immortal coal of the universe, Leibniz's mirroring monads, daybeams of consciousness. I see their heads sway at the 7 o'clock lecture. I imagine they forget the hungers, the desperate fears in the hollow parts of their bodies, the physiological smells, the sardine cans, the flitch of bacon, the chicken bones gathered neatly to one side of the plate. Life is horrifying, said Cézanne, but this is not what he meant who picked flowers blooming in the slaughterhouse. He meant the slit throats, the bear traps smeared with blood, the iron goads, the frightened servant girl Caesarian, and this planet dancing about Apollo, the blood drying and shining in the sun, turning to Titians, beauty, the arts. My heart is parted like the Red Sea. It cracks. And where the cleft is formed, the barbari carrying their chromium gods on their sunburnt arms and shoulders, ride on my nightmares, a hot desert wind pushing them swiftly toward these faces washed clean of death and agony. God, God, shall I jiggle my gourd haunches to make these faces laugh? Shall the blood rain down on these paper masks? Flamboyant light of the world, in this well-lit fluorescent age, you are a failure, lacking savvy. Gregor Metamorphosis, fantastic bogey louse. You are without meaning to those who nightly bed down on well-aired sheets. In the fifth row, someone pulls out a laundered emotion and wipes his long, false nose. At last the bell goes, Lear lamenting Cordelia, the wall's piercing cry. You may grieve now, gentlemen. Here's one, somewhat more cheerful, appropriate, I suppose, for the time of the year, the season, the weather. Composition in late spring. When love ensnares my mind unbidden, I am lost in the usual way on a crowded street or avenue where I am lord of all the marquees, and the traffic cop moving his lips like a poet composing whistles a discovery of sparrows about my head. My mind, full of goats and pirates and simpler than a boy's, I walk through a forest of white arms that embrace me like window shoppers. Friends praise me like a Turkish delight or a new kind of suspender, and children love me like a story. Conscience more flat than cardboard over the gap in a soul, I avoid the fanatic whose subway collapsed in his brain. There's a sinking, but the Madonna who clings to my hairlock is saved. On shore, the damned ones applaud with the vigor of bees. The sparrow's golden plummeting from fearful rooftop shows the flesh dying into sunshine. Fled to the green suburbs, death lies scared to death under a heap of bones. Beauty buds from mire, and I, a singer in season, observe death as a name for beauty not in use. No one is more happy. None can do more tricks. The sun melts like butter over my sweet corn thoughts. And at last, both famous and good, I'm a doge, a dog at the end of a terrace where poems like angels, like flakes of powder, quaver above my prickling skin. Birth of tragedy. And me happiest when I compose poems. Love, power, the huzzah of battle are something, are much. Yet a poem includes them like a pool, water, and reflection. In me, nature's divided things, tree, mold on tree, have their fruition. I am their core. Let them swap, bandy, like a flame swerve. I am their mouth. As a mouth, I serve. And I observe how the sensual moths, big with odor and sunshine, dart into the perilous shrubbery, or drop their visiting shadows upon the garden I one year made of flowering stone to be a footstool for the perfect gods, who, friends to the ascending orders, sustain all passionate meditations and call down pardons for the insurgent blood. A quiet madman, never far from tears, I lie like a slain thing under the green air the trees inhabit, or rest upon a chair towards which the inflammable air tumbles on many robin's wings, noting how seasonably leaf and blossom uncurl and living things arrange their death, while someone from afar off blows birthday candles for the world. And here's a secret as to how poems get written. I'll let it out gratis. How poems get written. Like a memory torn at the shoulders, my darling wears the chemise I gave her, a wedding gift. At night, I tap out my poems on her hip bone. When she can't sleep either, we write the poem together. And this misunderstanding I placed my hand upon her thigh. By the way she moved away, I could see her devotion to literature was not perfect. Latria, which is a devotion. Give me, dark one, these. A woman's white knees, a woman's fine eyes, her hot, lathered thighs, the nuptial embrace, the first look of love, a bird, sparrow, or dove, the unscheming face, any bloom, a rose, creation's frenzy, the thrill of pity, the rest is prose. How to look at an abstract. When I got the hang of it, I saw a continent of railway tracks coiling about the sad Modigliani necks like disused ticker tape. The streets exploding in the air with disaffected subway cars. So help me, when I got the hang of it, I said, the nylon stockings filled with liverwurst, an honest word for rage weeping by broken pylons, middle class America's pooped, played out, she's had it. Cut up the hash chef and take out the chromium cinders. The cold green element, which is the grass, water, life. The poem is all about that, and about my feeling about grass and water and life. The cold green element that we are all submerged in. At the end of the garden walk, The wind and its satellite wait for me. Their meaning I will not know until I go there. But the black-hatted undertaker who passing saw my heart beating in the grass is also going there. Hi, I tell him. A great squall in the Pacific blew a dead poet out of the water who now hangs from the city's gates. Crowds depart daily to see it and return with grimaces and incomprehension. If its limbs twitched in the air, they would sit at its feet peeling their oranges. And turning over, I embraced like a lover the trunk of a tree, one of those for whom the lightning was too much, and grew a brilliant hunchback with a crown of leaves. The ailments escaped from the labels of medicine bottles are all fled to the wind. I've seen myself lately in the eyes of old women, spent streams mourning my manhood, in whose old pupils the sun became a blood smear on broad catalpa leaves, and hanging from ancient twigs, my murdered selves sparked the air like the muted collisions of fruit. A black dog howls down my blood, a black dog with yellow eyes. He too, by someone's inadvertence, saw the blood smear on the broad catalpa leaves. But the Furies clear a path for me to the worm who sang for an hour in the throat of a robin. And misled by the cries of young boys, I am again a breathless swimmer in that cold green element. And here's a bitter poem about science outstripping man's moral intuitions, the great danger, of course, of the 20th century. And my symbol for this science is the improved binoculars. One of the most bitter poems that I have written, but I felt very strongly at the time that I wrote it, and I still think it's true. The improved binoculars. Below me, the city was in flames. The firemen were the first to save themselves. I saw steeples fall on their knees. I saw an agent kick the charred bodies from an orphanage to one side, marking the site carefully for a future speculation. Lovers stopped short of the final spasm and went off angrily in opposite directions, their elbows held by giant escorts of fire. Then the dignitaries rode across the bridges under an oracle of light which delighted them, noting for later punishment those that went before. And the rest of the populace, their mouths distorted by an unusual gladness, bawled thanks to this comely and ravaging ally, asking only for more light with which to see their neighbor's destruction. All this I saw through my improved binoculars. For Louise, age 17. She came to us recommended by the golden minutes and by nothing else. Her skin glowed, sang with the compliments which these same minutes paid her. Her hair burned like a yellow fire to celebrate the strange beauty of her face. Herself? She walked unconscious of the need she started in us to praise, admire the elegance we found in us like a vein of rare silver when we saw her. But all our thoughts were caught in the compass of her royal arms, and we sank down into the dark where the blood sings after dark, into the light because it was the light, into the clear valley where her body was made. Her beauty had lain, now resurrected, raised by the minutes which start, slay, their ivory hafts fiery with sun motes, which crying, we cease to make an immortal ring for beauty, which is its own excuse and never dies. This next poem is written for my daughter. It's called Song for Naomi. It was written several years ago. We had gone to the country, and my daughter was much shorter than the grasses near the edge of the lake. And that was a great worry to myself and to my wife. Because if she ever fell into the lake, we'd never know it, you see. At the end of the summer, just before we were ready to pack up, I found that my daughter had grown taller than the grasses near the lake. And so I wrote this poem. Song for Naomi. Who is that in the tall grasses singing by herself near the water? I cannot see her, but can it be her than whom the grasses so tall are taller? My daughter, my lovely daughter. Who is that in the tall grasses running beside her near the water? She cannot see there time that pursued her in the deep grasses so fast and faster and caught her, my foolish daughter. What is the wind in the fair grass saying like a verse near the water? Saviors that over all things have power, make time himself grow kind and kinder that sought her, my little daughter. Who is that at the close of the summer near the deep lake? Who wrought her comely and slender? Time but attends and befriends her, than whom the grasses, though tall, are not taller. My daughter, my gentle daughter. The bull calf. Many years ago, I worked on a farm. We had Jersey cows. And there was a bull calf that was born, and it wasn't profitable to keep this bull calf, and so the owner of the farm decided that he had to be killed. I didn't have to kill the bull calf, but I did have to bury it. Many years later, I wrote this poem, The Bull Calf. Of course, a bull calf here is my symbol for everything in life that is proud and arrogant and strong. And for one reason or another, old age, death, some accident,